You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
I'm Tanya Pinkins. Welcome back to part two of my conversation with Michael R. Jackson, 2020 Pulitzer Prize winner in drama. You're listening to You Can't Say That on the Broadway Podcast Network.
So let's talk about self-loathing, because that's when that comes up for me all the time. Deep, deep self-loathing. Like whenever I do mushrooms or anything, like I go through hours of just self-loathing, and I don't try to resist it. I just go into it. You know, what is it for you?
I mean, I will say that, like, I feel like writing the show for me was living the show first, because I started writing.
It sounds hard.
Because I started writing it when I was 21.
Okay.
And I didn't finish writing it until I was 38.
So cathartic, like.
So what I'm saying is that, like, the show from the very beginning when I started writing it was, I didn't know I was writing a musical to begin with, because I wasn't. It was just a monologue, mm-hmm. but it was always about a young Black gay man sort of walking through his life and his thoughts about himself and the world and trying to figure out what was wrong with him. And it was, but I didn't know that formally that's what the story was. Because I didn't know that in my own life, my problem was that I thought something was wrong with me. And there, in fact, was not anything wrong with me.
And you sure about that now?
I am, because, like, I went through so many years of struggle and writing and therapy and, like, friends and, like, and literally coming to this conclusion, oh, nothing's wrong with you. It doesn't mean that I don't have, like, my up days and my down days, but that core belief that I am not worthy is gone.
And I wonder where that comes from. Cause, like, I feel like I know where it comes from for me, because I grew up in a family that came up from Mississippi and Louisiana.
Yeah. Oh, I can tell you where it came white from.
So where'd yours come from?
Mine came from, you know, being born into a family that loved me deeply, but did not have the tools to support me emotionally.
Is it because you're gay?
That was part of it. I mean, but, like, it was even before I knew I was gay, I was still, like, very sensitive and, like, soft. And, like, I watched soap operas and every day. And, like,
but everybody, all the Black people watch soap operas.
No, but, like, not little black boys all the way through, like, high school into college.
The football players, all the soap fans, all the basketball players.
You know what I mean? Like, I, like, didn't like to go outside and play sports. I was into music and theater. I was very sensitive. I would cry, you know, it's my hurt my feelings. Like, and my parents were just, like, they didn't know. And, like, and once I did come out, like, they didn't know how to support me emotionally at that time. And so, and then on top of that, like, I would get made fun of at school and told that I thought I was white or that I was a sissy or that, just all the things. I was fat. I had a lisp. I was, like, all the things, like, you know,
that America says you don't get to be.
Right. And then, right. That then, like, you know, and then taking that into, even when, like, I always tell people that, like, I grew up in a very interesting moment in the mid to late 90s where there were a ton of Black gay boys around me. Like, at a moment when, like, people like Ellen were starting to come out, but, like, that was for white people and not for us. And so, but we had this whole sort of underground thing where, like, boys were dating and sleeping with each other and all this stuff. But even that, I was, like, on the outside of it for the most part. And so, like, but, and I hungered. I wanted to be with those boys. And then I moved to New York. And then suddenly in New York, it's, like, white gays and then, and the white racism of the gaytriarchy.
Right, because you got to your body got to be hard and you got to work out 20 times a day.
Exactly, and all those things contributed to this feeling that, like, I just am not enough. You know, and then the creative, and, like, in school, like, this play is, like, not relevant because it's not white, you know, all the bullshit, all of it, all of that contributed to this idea of, like, I am not enough. And yet, my writing was the thing that was a constant since I was a little kid, and my music was a constant thing that I could go to for sustenance. And so I think that plus having, like, the presence of mind to seek out therapy many, many, many times over the—
What kind of therapist? What flavor was the therapist?
I mostly did cognitive behavioral, but then the last major therapy I went into was gestalt therapy, which ended up being, like, really, really useful for me because it was all about what's going on in your body. And like when you go and when you feel terrible, what does your body, like where is the tension in your body exists? And for me, it turned out it was all, usually always in my stomach. Like it would see, I would seize up if I was like scared or sad or whatever, like my stomach would like seize up. And like, and so when we would, I would work with my therapist at the time, when we would talk about whatever was going on that week, and I would start getting emotional about something, she would be like, what's going on in your stomach right now? And I'd have to stop and be like, oh, it's tense or whatever. And she, and we would tap it out. And like, I'd tap on my body to like a phrase, and it would sort of bring it up and like sort of release it.
Like, and you'd have an emotional release from the tapping?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, sometimes yes and sometimes no, but yeah, it was like very powerful. Cause you'd say something, you'd be like, even though I hate my job, I completely and totally accept myself. Even though my mother called me a faggot, I mean, my mother didn't call me a faggot, but my mother called me a faggot, I completely and totally accept myself. You tap on a different place in your body, like whatever it was, like a phrase or phrases, and it would just bring stuff up out of you. And I found that, and I didn't, and I always thought it was like corny when I first started doing it, but the more we did it, like it actually forced me to like recognize what, like putting my body and my emotions together. And I found that to be a helpful thing while at the same time, like writing and making music and being creative. And all of that, I think, helped me come to the realization that nothing was actually wrong with me, that I was going through life, like searching for like this answer of why am I like this? Why do I always feel this way? Why do am I so sensitive? Why does it hurt my feelings so bad when they reject me or this happens or that happens? And like the answer was like, because you're a human and nothing is wrong with you. Mm. And so that was, and the show was like circling, was spinning its wheels for many years before I realized the formal structure of that, that had to contain that realization.
So I want to go back to this musical about white girls. what's the premise of it?
So White Girl in Danger, it's called White Girl in Danger, but that's, it's ironic. What it is like, so as I mentioned, I grew up on soap operas. Like my great aunt Ruth used to watch me before I was old enough to go to school. And we would watch Young and the Restless at 12:30, Days of Our Lives at 1, Another World at 2, Santa Barbara at 3. And that was like, and I just grew up engrossed in these soap operas. And the thing that I didn't realize at the time about doing that, because I then grew up, I then started watching them on my own. I started recording them. I came to New York actually with the dream of becoming the head writer of One Life to Live. That's why I moved. I interned at All My Children, where you used to work.
What, was I there?
No, you, no, this was because you were, I think you were gone by like the late 90s, or did you came back though? Like
they
on and
drop
off.
Me in every now and again.
But like in the early, in the early days when you're there, I wasn't there, and I didn't start watching All My Children until college anyway. But like I interned there.
Black person are you who didn't watch All My Children? That was the number one black show in America.
Even over YNR with Drusilla and them.
Over YNR.
Interesting. Okay. I just didn't. I was a Days of Our Lives boy in Another World, and then One Life to Live. Anyway. The thing I didn't realize at the time when I was watching was that I was learning about story, and that like in stories in America, but certainly across the globe, we are taught that like we're taught to prioritize, is the white girl okay? and that was a thing that I realized that I was learning. That was sort of at the heart of like a lot of storytelling. Is the white girl okay? Is she, you know, and she always played two roles. Either she was the villainess or she was a victim. And that both of these ideas of this white woman were happening not just in narrative fiction, but like in American reality. So like that's how you get someone like Carolyn Bryant. Mm. A black man touched me. On the next All My Children. Do you know what I mean? Or like that, or that woman who shot, the woman who shot Terrence Crutcher, that performance that she gave, she should have gotten a Best Scene Stealer, a Soap Opera Digest Award for that. Mm. Like, he was the most worst in my life. Like, Erica Kane is a Karen. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean?
Yes.
And I've been like, so fascinated by what, and like, once I like sort of realized that, anyway, those are all like thematic realizations, but the show, what the show is about is it's set in a sort of Lifetime movie, daytime TV universe, not a set, mm-hmm. but the actual world of it. So like in a town called All White, like Pine Valley, Landview, but the name of the town, universe, world, whatever is All White.
And are there all white people in it?
And it's no. And so there's all white characters in it who are like, they had their like trope problems. And then there's a class of people called the Black Round.
And the Black Round.
And the Black Round are the characters who are just there to be day player, under five, kind of people who live in the world, in the realities of the all whites.
Who cook and clean and
do all everything. Who do everything. And like one of the Black Round is this girl named Keisha, who decides she's got what it takes to be a protagonist of her own all white story. So she sort of begs the writer of the universe to please let her be a protagonist, an all white protagonist. And he like sort of strikes her with lightning, and he, and the story begins to revolve around her. And like her hair slowly starts turning blonde, like over the course of the show. And as, and her main rivals are three all white girls named Negan, Megan, and Megan. And like, she sort of, she manages to like usurp their story, their like, their storylines from them. And when she does that, the story begins to revolve around this Black girl at the center of an all white story. But then there's a killer on the loose who's killing off all the all white protagonists. And so the killer starts to go after her. And then the killer's identity is like a whole big shocker. And it's just this meditation on representation and stories. Mm-hmm. And this idea of equity, diversity, and inclusion. Like what, like what are some of the problems of that? So
have you seen Hair Wolf?
No, I haven't.
You gotta see Hair Wolf, Hair Wolf on HBO. It's Mariama Diallo, amazing little short. Cara Young is in it.
Oh, Cara Young.
Yes, you got to see Hair Wolf.
Okay.
You're going to love it.
Yeah.
It's a little like 16-minute short film.
Okay, I'll check it out. But
you 12 know, minutes maybe.
But yeah, but it's like, it's also like a show that's a love letter to my love of soap operas. I love the form. I absolutely do. And I always have. And I never got to be the head writer of One Life to Live. So for this show, it's kind of like my, I got to get that out of my system. And it's like very funny, but it's also like dark and crazy and I'm excited about it.
They must be wooing you to TV now.
Yes. I'm by hook or by crook. I'm going to get there because I need some money.
Okay. So you want to go, you want to make that jump.
I do want it. I mean, I don't ever want to not do theater, but I do want to actually be able to support myself and my family if I need to.
What kind of show, give me a show that you would want to write on.
Or
a show you want to create.
Well, it's funny because I haven't had any interviews to staff anything yet. And mm-hmm. so I've only been working on pitching my own shows so far.
Great. That's fantastic.
So like one show that I'm pitching, I can't get too into it, but like absolutely. it's going to be a show that's sort of like it just like This Is Us, there's dual timelines, but right. It's about a Black man who for a lot of reasons ends up coming back to his hometown to teach at the high school that he went to 25 mm-hmm. years earlier. And he's mm-hmm. like a Black gay man. And like, it's, you're seeing like both timelines at the same time mm-hmm. of him mm-hmm. as like a young person, because a friend of his dies shockingly of AIDS. And like, you're sort of tracking, how did all of this happen? Why did all these changes happen through this one person's lens? And it's sort of loosely based on my experience of like growing up with all these Black gay teenagers in the mid to late 90s, which I just think is, it was a whole other world. It's a different world than where you come from. Like, mm-hmm. And I feel like people would be interested to see the like the intrigue of that, and the like mm-hmm. the class differences mm-hmm. in like growing up in a city like Detroit. It's like I got very much saw high, middle, low within a Black context.
Right.
And so I'm really interested to write a show that shows that.
Praised by Lin-Manuel Miranda as the future of musical theater, SUFS creator Shayna Taub makes Broadway history as only the second woman to write the book, music, lyrics, and star in her own original new musical. Don't miss the much-anticipated Broadway debut of the singular artist that Forbes calls visionary and Billboard anoints as one of the most inventive voices in musical theater. Suf's The Original New Musical from Shana Taub is now playing on Broadway at the Music Box Theater. Get your tickets today at suffsmusical.com. The Outsiders on Broadway tells the story of finding where you belong when the world refuses to accept you. Based on S.E. Hinton's beloved novel, featuring new music from Jamestown Revival and Justin Levine, and directed by Danya Taymor, Entertainment Weekly says that, with brilliant staging and some of the most captivating stage fighting currently on Broadway, The Outsiders has the power to inspire an entire generation. Get your tickets today at outsidersmusical.com.
So this is going to air during Pride. And this is, you know, I may not get a chance to talk to anybody else about something like this. So when I think about gay pride and gay rights, I think about it as the patriarchy.
We had the gatriarchy.
All these rich white men, many of them closeted. They couldn't get out, but they could give their money so that these, you know, that it's this really.
Some of them are Trump supporters.
Right. Yep. You know, it's a weird kind of thing. That it is still a patriarchal movement, and for brown people, for women even who are gay identified, the movement is still a white male patriarch kind of movement.
Yeah, it is. I mean, and that's like the reason why like I vacillate back and forth between gay and queer. Because to me, to say that I'm gay sometimes just feels like a very specific capitalist identifying statement. Which does not really match my life or my politics. And queer feels more like expansive of my sort of my politics and of my artistic lens and so forth. But it's hard. Like I don't enjoy going to like Pride events and things like that. I remember like my most notable Pride events was the first one I went to was when Hillary Clinton was running for Senate, and she just like popped up like waving around everybody and then disappeared. And then the next one I remember was when Anthony Weiner was like trying to run for re-election or something after the scandal.
Penis?
Yes, and I yelled out, "Show us your dick!"
Yeah, that'll get you elected. Go over there and put a glory hole up.
Right, and it was just like a whole like I just have never really enjoyed it. Except for like maybe if I just have like my actual friends around me and we're doing something that's just for us, but the like the corporate nature of it and the like the way in which it's not really about Black people or about people of color, you know, it's so rooted in like a capitalist striving.
Yeah,
that's just not what I'm interested in or about. And so I feel very meh on it.
Yeah. Tell me something. I mean, I want to know this about your parents. Did your parents even know what the Pulitzer was? I don't know your parents.
So
thing.
When like, I called, so, well, I have to say this first. Everybody was asking me, are your parents coming to see the show? Are they going to see the show? And I was like, yeah, they're coming. And then they're like, did they see it? What do they think? And I was like, they loved it. My parents... I have a recording somewhere. I have to find it on my computer. But my parents like held court in the lobby of Playwrights Horizons, just like beaming. Like they were so fucking proud of me. And they were so happy. And they like loved, they just were so impressed by the show and by, I don't think that they really got all of it, but like they just, that their baby, because they know how long it's taken me. This is my first professional production.
That's fantastic.
After 20 years in New York City.
Nobody knows if you're too late. They only know if you're too early.
Right. And so like they just were like giving us speeches about like, Michael used to always just have a book in his hand. Michael used to just read. Always was reading. Like, you know what I mean? And like,
yes.
And then my mom was like, we didn't know much about the show, and there was one part he should have told us about.
I think I know what part that was.
And but like they were just beaming, and they were so happy because like they don't. This is not their world. They don't even barely come to New York. And like, and they just were so happy. So then like when the Pulitzer came, I called my mother and I was like, Mom, I have something to tell you. I was like, and she's like, what, what? It's like, I won the Pulitzer. And my mom goes, what's that? And then I was like, I'm gonna send you the email. And then like when I sent her, when I sent her the email, she like opened it while we were on the phone. She's like, oh my goodness, oh, I'm proud of you. Like she, then she got it. And my dad knew what it was. And like, they just were so excited. And they've been like, aww, on like cloud nine for everything, because they just had seen how hard, how many years I was like, there were so many times over the years where they were just like, what you gonna do with that? Mm. Because it just didn't, because there was, and there was no way for me to explain how the business worked, because
and
I
in their
know.
Time, they couldn't do what you did.
Right, they couldn't, but like, but they also were the ones who, when I had a full scholarship to Michigan State and told them I wanted to go to expensive ass NYU, they're like, well, we'll just take out a like gazillion dollar student parent plus loan for you to go, because you
that's what you want to do.
You want to do, and like, and we've seen you as a little kid writing, and like, because when I was in middle school and high school, I like wrote, and I was in literary magazines, and I like would go to the Michigan Youth Arts Festival, and I got like my short stories published in little literary magazines for $100 or whatever. And so they saw that it was something I was like good at and wanted to do, and so they made like a truly insane sacrifice for me. And so for to see the show, thankfully, you know, be the success that it was, and to be rewarded like on this level for them, like they're so happy, and I like seeing that in them.
Yes,
because I want that for them. It's like they get to have something, and because it's not, their life is not easy right now. They're retired. Mm-hmm. They're on a fixed income. They're older. They have various health problems, but they get to have.
Go get to be a showrunner, yeah, and just make their life easy.
That's what I hope. That's what I hope to do.
I'm standing in agreement. It's going to happen.
Yeah.
So what, you know, 20 years is a long time. What, how did you stay in it? What, you know, what kept you going?
Well, I
why didn't you quit and go back and work for the post office or be a police officer?
Right. Well, I luckily, I actually got a like writing job right out of grad school. Mm-hmm. And I mean, it was for a project that I should not have said yes to. And so I spent a lot of years just thinking, because I'd come out of a program where you learn how to just collaborate and like do assignments. Yes. I just thought, oh, I can do anything because I've been trained in how to do this. What right. I didn't yet know then is that like musicals are like really a commitment and really hard. And so you have to be really invested in what the story was. And this was not a story I was really invested in. And I spent like 5 years floundering on that. And like my advance ran out and everything. And then at that point I had to like get temp jobs. I started ushering at the New Amsterdam Theater when the Lion King was there and Mary Poppins. So I ushered for 5 years. I did flyering for Rock of Ages, more temping. I took out credit card advances on like every credit card I could get them on. And then I got this like job as a finance clerk at an ad agency, which I did that for 5 years. And it was like, that's where I also learned about racism in corporate America. Mm. I then got a job. I quit that job and I went to be an executive assistant at a nonprofit, which was like a flip side of like a mirror flip side of kind of racism in the world, but like from the like NGO,
yeah,
like nice white lady running a nonprofit side, you know?
Yeah.
And that sort of thing. But also just capitalism. I learned during that whole period of time, capitalism will squeeze everything out of you. It does not care about your little race or your little, you know, needs or your healthcare or your anything.
It's a death system. It's cannibalistic. It will cannibalize itself.
Exactly. So I learned that. And then, and, you know, when I was writing throughout all of that, and I had various support, artistic support systems, like the Musical Theater Factory, which Shakina Nabak had invited me. And she was actually really key because she had invited me into MTF right as it was beginning. Mm-hmm. And she was like, do you have anything you're working
That's
on?
That's who introduced like, well, me to you.
Right. I was like, there. I've had this musical I've been working on and off. And I brought it in, and that sort of began the actual momentum to production, because people sort of took note of it, and like I started getting various developmental opportunities as after doing a reading at MTF, and so I had that, but I was still working these horrible jobs, and I just didn't give myself a plan B, really. Okay. I think that's the truth of it, is that I was like, I don't have anything else to fall back on. I can't be a police officer or work at the post office. I'm a writer, and I'll just work these jobs and eke by. And
right. And you love hopefully the writing. The love of the writing is such that you're doing whatever you have to do to be able to do that, because it's what you were here right. to do. So,
which is what I had already done. Like, I took out this massive loan, and my parents took this massive loan just so I could do it.
Yeah.
And so, like, that, if I can't make it, if I can't make it there, I can't make it anywhere. I don't know. Like, I just kept at it because I didn't have a plan B.
So right now, we're in the midst of a pandemic, an uprising. As an artist, what is your vision? What do you see happening? And not like in a like how you're going to make it if you were God, but what are you sensing is the evolution that we're happening? What do you see happening? What do you think's going happening right now?
Well, I mean, I kind of feel like a lot of this, I think there's a lot happening, obviously. And I think one piece of it is hinging on the election in November.
Yeah.
That, like, I feel like all the sort of chaos in some ways is spinning around that, just as like, as a psychic thing in our
minds. Absolutely.
It's kind of like, because we're just kind of like, how do we live in this world with this crazy man?
Right.
You know, daddy is like on a bender, and like, how do we like deal with that? But then there's another part of it that I feel very much right now, like the chickens of neoliberalism are like coming home to roost. In like a major, major, major way. The ways in which the left/Democratic Party, liberal, whatever, has failed us again and again, yes. and again and again and again and again. And now, people are like so desperate for anything to sustain them and to sustain us. And it's happening all over the world. We're seeing neoliberalism like failing everywhere, right. whether it's in Brazil or in the UK or,
And fascism on the rise.
And fascism on the rise. Like, I think about places, I always think it's interesting, like, when people talk about Donald Trump being a dictator, and I'm like, well, he hasn't quite convinced the military to be on his side yet.
Well, there's some rumor that that was what was happening this week. He was about to do a military coup, and that's what brought Mattis to speak.
Right, but I'm just like, I've not ever been certain that the military is fully ready, is like really ready to get behind him like that, in part because there's part of what we've been seeing with like the Republicans and conservatives who hate Trump or say they hate Trump, is that what they don't like about him is that he deviates from their sort of collaboration with the Democrats on a lot of foreign policy. And on certain issues. And like, so I don't know, but like, I don't see the military getting behind him the way, say, they do, like, what's happened in the Philippines, mm-hmm. or with Duterte, or like what's happening with Bolsonaro. Mm-hmm. Like, but we shall see. I mean, perhaps this uprising and this, the economic insecurity that everyone's facing, all of that will force that to happen. But for now, I feel like neoliberalism is like the chickens of that are coming home to roost in lots of different places. Honestly, that's like as far as I've gotten in my like my crystal balling, because it's just there's so much shit going on the streets. And
yeah, watching these cops beat people down like Rodney King every night. Yeah, it's frightening.
But it's like interesting. It's like that we're watching people beat people down on the streets, but we're also seeing people like this whole debate about racism on Broadway, like all of those things, like those two things are happening at the same time. And I'm like, Broadway is closed. Broadway is closed
for a long
time. You can't burn it down. It might burn itself down just because there's like no one's going and there's no money. And like, that's part of what I've been having a lot of angst around that conversation. I don't know how much in it you are.
I'm not in and out of it.
Right, right. But it's just like, I'm like, why are we talking about racism on Broadway when
there is no Broadway?
When there's no Broadway. And like, there's people dying in the streets. And very uncomfortably, for some of these conversations, it feels like the people dying in the street is being used as a pivot to talk about racism on Broadway in our careers. And if that is a real thing, like, I find that to be the these bourgeois politics that are part of neoliberalism that I find utterly disgusting, distasteful, immoral. And I've been struggling to, like, I've been subtweeting about it because I don't want to get into it.
What's
because
subtweeting?
My brain is not free. Because
what's subtweeting?
Meaning like you, somebody says something and then you say something, but they don't really know that you're talking about them. But like, I mean, it's also, I'm not very subtle, but like, because I'm feeling like my rage is not free about that either. Like I'm trying to, I actually care about what I care about is like my safety and I do want to tell stories. I don't want to burn Broadway down.
Yes.
I want to take my story to Broadway. I think that me and my creative team and my producers, that we've worked very hard to make something that like is about people coming together to share this experience about a Black queer man realizing that nothing's wrong with him. I think that's a very powerful, moving story. As you know, that's not someone dying in the street. Why wouldn't we want to share a story like that? Or a Black woman not being raped and killed, you know, like whatever it is, like
no more poverty porn. We don't have to have the poverty porn all the time.
Yeah, like Bell Hooks. I love what Bell Hooks said. That like, if I never see a Black woman raped and murdered in my life on screen, I will be happy. And she talks about the imagination as a space for liberty, and I'm just really down for that, you know. And like, and you, and as a creator, as an artist, you can make whatever you want. It's a choice. You don't, no one says it like you have to show people being killed and murdered on stage or something.
Well, I love horror movies, so I'm gonna tell you that.
No, I do too. And I can have an idea.
I make a lot of horror movies.
No, I do too. I think horror movies also are another thing that like can show us who we are.
Exactly.
And like I have an idea for a horror movie as well that I gotta like finally sit my ass down to write. But
it's been a pleasure.
But thank you, Tanya. It's been such a pleasure to talk to
it's
you.
It's a pleasure. We should just do it, you know, when we can actually break bread again.
I look forward to that. Anytime.
And enjoy the glows of being a Pulitzer Prize winner. And yeah, I look forward to seeing you on the other side.
Thank you. Likewise. Be well. Be safe.
You're listening to Tanya Pinkins, You Can't Say That, on the Broadway Podcast Network. And that was my conversation with 2020 Pulitzer Prize winner in drama, Michael R. Jackson.
Thanks for listening to You Can't Say That, the show where you can. I'm Tanya Pinkins. This is part of the Broadway Podcast Network, produced by Dori Berenstein and Alan Seals, edited by Derek Gunther, music by Anthony Norman, available wherever you get your podcast. And visit me on Twitter and Facebook and Instagram, and let me know what you'd like to hear me talk about. For more information, visit bpn.fm/YCST.
They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com. If you love Broadway gossip, you are not going to want to miss any episode of this podcast, Singular Sensation, The Triumph of Broadway. Plenty of dramas unfold on stage, but the best dramas unfold backstage. And there were no bigger dramas than behind the scenes of Sunset Boulevard.
So you were being crucified over here, but not there.
No. No, because I was turning in a performance that would get standing ovations. Excuse me.
So check out my podcast, Singular Sensation, for all the juicy and gory details of Sunset Boulevard.